Good afternoon, listeners and viewers, and welcome to another episode of Disrupt Ed, where we talk to the thought leaders out there that are helping us to shape an understanding and create better opportunities from this ginormously disrupted world of work and learning. And today, I'm extremely pleased to welcome an old friend and a tremendous mind in the world of disruption, in the world of innovation, and that's none other than Dr. Professor Peter Thames, formerly on the faculty of Harvard University and now running his own organization, Innovation in Large Organizations. Peter, welcome to today's show. I'm so eager to have you here.
Thank you, Ron, and you are too kind as usual, but always a pleasure to be with you and learn from you.
So Peter and I first began collaborating about 15 years ago when he brought his show on the road, and he takes the ILO across the country and does speaking engagements and events with a series of C-level thought leaders and executives on topics that are germane to the function of innovation in very large organizations. The cool thing about what Peter does is that he supports these arguments, supports these animated conversations, supports these connections with real-time research into the subjects. And so the topic we're going to be talking about today is one that, quite honestly, it kind of freaks me out. And it's the whole idea of decarbonization, because I hear all these stories about how the world is becoming too carbon rich for our own good, and we run the risk of really destroying a good way of life on this planet as we know it. And yet, when you listen to Peter talk about this, and it's very fascinating, our earlier conversations reminded me of a conversation that took place between Ezra Pound and James Joyce when Ezra Pound was rotting in jail. And he said, just remember one thing, it's not the politics that concerns me, it's style. And there's a lot of politics in decarbonization, depending upon what side of the aisle you're on. And yet, Peter, from my understanding, as you've brought together this carbonization, decarbonization group, you're finding that politics plays very little role in the discussions you're having. So why don't you kick us off and share a little bit about what you're doing with this amazing group of thought leaders and executives?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you so much. So, you know, our core group, the ILO Institute, the Institute for Innovation in Large Organizations, has been in existence almost 20 years now, 18 plus. And we typically have a cohort of organizational members that are generally multi-billion dollar private global companies, but also U.S. government agencies, NASA, the Department of Defense, the public health system of Texas. And we're working with folks across the whole economy. We're talking about innovation. We're talking about supporting, making positive change, adopting new technologies, and even more important, how organizations are reshaped by those new technologies, right? The kind of org chart changes, the communications changes, the way people think about work because of this incredible arc we've been on with internet-related technologies in particular. And our members get to assign us research, which is a really interesting kind of forward radar for us. And beginning maybe 2 years ago, folks who weren't necessarily in the energy sector began giving us research assignments about decarbonization and sustainability. You know, what's happening across the insurance sector? Who's doing what? How much money is at risk? How much money is being made? What happens next? What's happening in the auto sector with the new Ford F-150 all-electric, which is in this category called V2X, which is to say you charge your truck, it holds the equivalent of 3 days worth of energy to run the average American household. So now this thing is going to put the portable gas-powered motor generator out of business eventually, which means every construction site where they've already got, you know, a sprawling lot filled with F-150s, they're going to be polluting less, but they're also going to be creating new businesses, pulling businesses out of the economy. And you're going to see that 3-day charge go to 10 days, 30 days. You're going to see the emergence of gridless cities. You're going to see something like in California, where the electric utility has to have these power lines going to these thinly populated areas. and they're regularly setting the state on fire because they're very, very hard to maintain. You're going to see battery powered, you're going to see robots, you're going to see all kinds of things there that will be able to get, like that big truck that will be powering a house, not for 3 days, but for 30 days. You're going to see that wave in the next 10, 20 years for the big fantasy oriented stuff, which is well beyond fantasy. And you're already seeing hundreds of billions of dollars flowing through the American economy only. And I'll talk about that in a sec. But we're at the beginning, and this is one big reason that the politics, which are important for the political conversation, are really being nudged aside. And in particular, you know, we do a lot of work. We are secular about who you vote for when you come into our space and want to talk about how to make positive change. But when we pull people together for this series of larger events that we've been doing, 50 people from big firms coming in, and we're trying to advance the conversation. We often say about decarbonization, our little organization cannot advance the science, but we can advance the conversation. That's what we're good at. And we're seeing people who desperately need to know things and don't know that they desperately need to know things, having those eureka moments. But when you come into that room, you can be voting for Donald Trump instead of eating quiche with Hillary Clinton. That's fine. You can be in a heavy industry, Midwest-based, tough guy engineering culture. But already, particularly in those sectors, you see many billions of dollars flowing specifically into low carbon emissions and no carbon emissions infrastructure. So if you look as an example at the public utility, the privately owned electric power businesses like Con Ed in New York, like CMS, which is one of our members, Con Ed has been a member as well, in Michigan, they have mandates to build, and they're constantly rebuilding their grids. The rule of thumb is in that space, about 50% of total income a year goes into rebuilding and maintaining the grid.
Wait, stop right there. 50% of their revenue is spent rebuilding their infrastructure.
Correct.
Amazing.
So, you know, that there are probably well over 100 multi-billion dollar, I'm pausing. There we go. Is this easy for you to edit out?
Yeah.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Can we get 20 minutes of quiet before you get heavy? Great. Thank you. So you've got literally about 100 of these private corporations who are publicly traded, but operating effectively with state monopolies to run your local electric grid. The rule of thumb forever has been about half of their gross revenue goes into building and rebuilding infrastructure every year. That's always been the case.
You know, what I find fascinating about what you're saying is that so many people now coming into this arena and into this ecosystem are looking at the problems of decarbonization differently. And I give you as an example, an upcoming guest that's going to follow you, Peter, is Mujeeb Ajit, who is the founder of Our Next Energy here in Michigan. And he's going to be building a billion-dollar battery plant. And we're going to be talking with him about that. But when you listen to him talk about energy management, he's not foreseeing a future that he can make money at in the near term with car batteries. So he's beginning to build his research and development around the existing concern, which is energy management and energy capture.
Right.
So I think this is what's fascinating about it, is we can quickly move the politics to the side and look at decarbonization basically as a business model and how do we optimize it now, right?
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. So you have someone like the head of the Future Utility Center at Con Ed, which is doing $12 to $14 billion a year supplying power across New York City, and a legacy business literally pumping steam all over Manhattan for old steam engine-like applications. There's a strong law in New York State from the state legislature. You can't build high carbon emissions infrastructure to support utility anymore. Done.
Anymore. Right? It's gone.
And they also effectively give Con Ed a license to have a monopoly power. When they spend $1 billion on infrastructure, they adjust the rates and guarantee a capital return to Con Ed. So they're kind of a creature of the state as well as being a private enterprise. Of that 12 to 14 billion, half today is going into contracts to build infrastructure that is low carbon emission or no carbon emission. So because of that, you have the giant construction firms, some of whom are members of our institute, and you go all the way down to local mom and pops, and you have these folks who are pulling in billions in contracts, and you've got the local guys who are pulling in single-digit millions, and they're on board to take the money. It doesn't matter who they vote for. So what we say when we have folks coming in for these sessions that we're running around the country is we say, look, if you want to talk about the politics, let's go get a beer and we'll do that later. It's an interesting and important conversation. But if you want to talk about this already emerging trillion-dollar wave of business, decarbonization as a platform for growth, bigger than the rise of the commercial internet, if you want to talk about that, there are two things you really need to believe. Number one, it is a good idea for humans to be able to generate and distribute electricity with much lower carbon emission than we have today as a baseline. That's an easy thing. Number two, there's a heck of a lot of money beginning to flow, and that's a good thing to be part of. If you believe those two things, we're going to have a great day, and you're going to learn things as an example about why in the commercial real estate sector in the U.S. alone, as soon as the SEC pulls the trigger on draft regulations already written and circulated to require what we call the Scope 3 emissions disclosure, which means if I'm publicly listed on a U.S. stock exchange, or if I'm in the supply chain in a meaningful way for any such company, I need to have an audit reporting my carbon emissions, and it goes up to the people I'm supplying. They own my numbers too, and they report that to the SEC. Their stock price goes up and down because
based on those valuations.
And therefore, 18% of the emissions are probably coming from office buildings you occupy as a multinational corporation. You're not going to want to rent space in my dirty building. You're going to want to rent space in my LEED Platinum
LEED,
building.
Right.
So half the customers for the dirtier buildings go away. The number of potential customers for the really clean buildings goes up. So this $100 million property is now worth $140. And this one over here is now worth $60-$70 because there's less demand, there's less rent roll. Prices have to fall to reflect the market. And that's going to ripple through the whole economy.
Peter, let me ask you this. You know, for the last decade or so, we've been hearing about trading carbon emissions among companies. You know? And, you know, as you debunk some of that in our, you know, in one of your recent events that I attended, it seems to me that that whole process of trying to cap emissions by selling them back and forth. That's a rounding error, an accounting thing. It's not really doing anything meaningfully. But what you're talking about, it appears to me, is realigning business incentives around the socially acceptable or socially necessary requirements for a greener planet, right? Because you're now, in effect, saying, hey, if you want to lower carbon emissions, this is a good business to be in. You can make some real money at it. Isn't that what you're saying, in effect?
Oh, 100%. Decarbonization is a platform for growth in several very large industries today, including electric utilities, including infrastructure building. We're close to the automotive industry getting there, the construction industry across the board, and they're having conversations about things like embedded carbon. So if I'm building with concrete, just creating the concrete is so energy intensive. My building could be absolutely clean, but as I need for this Scope 3 measurement, which is a much more comprehensive measure than just my thing that I own, clock starts there. It's like, no, we want the whole history of carbon in these things. Yeah, so there's tons of activity there that's really exciting. The carbon capture, carbon storage, carbon remediation business is a very strategically important one. And that's where there's a tremendous amount of scientific advancement that's early stage. I mean, there are a dozen technologies that work in a non-economic, low-scale way today that you can predict 10, 20 years are going to be terrific, very much like the arc that we've seen with solar and wind power. Solar is going up a little. There are these market dynamics where, you know, there was huge investment and other kind of second-step incentives from the U.S. government, and then China came in an even bigger way and really pushed these things to a kind of commercial scale, lower cost. You look at the alternative energy generation stuff, it was more expensive than traditional coal and other sources, natural gas. And then it really got cheaper fast. It's creeping back up in some areas only because now there's so much demand for it. There's more market capacity, and you're also kind of paying for the next level of R&D to get it fundamentally better. So that's gonna have a wave like this. While the fossil fuels is very hard to predict prices, fortunes are made and lost predicting the price of fossil fuels. But already we've seen in the U.S. the proportion of coal that goes into energy generation fall by well more than half. But the challenge is what does proportion mean in a dynamic global economy? We might be using three times the energy as back over there in X with half the coal. It's still more net emissions, which is what we have to get our hands on. And I am optimistic that we will. There are so many dimensions to how we kind of distribute and share the cost of what changing climate and changed climate does. That's a very interesting conversation. It's more interesting to me to talk about where the incremental advantages and opportunities are rather than how bad things could be.
Yeah, let me jump in here because it seems to me in the context of our disrupted community, there are two things we try to give our audience. And for those of you listening, you're joining me with Dr. Peter Thames, who's the founder of the Institute for Innovation in Large Organizations, formerly of the Harvard faculty, a college professor by background and intuition. And he's sharing this dynamic business model that he's describing as decarbonization. So, Peter, in this very disrupted world, our audience is looking for two things. Number one, how do you take my anxiety down? So that's with AI. How do you help me feel better about the fact that my job's not going to be eliminated tomorrow? Now with decarbonization, as you survey and do research with these large producers of energy and these large actors in the ecosystem, is this disruption going to make me feel better at the end of the night so I can sleep better about the state of the planet? Tell me more about, quantify that a little bit more for me, because that, I think, is what our audience is really interested in, is do we have to stop worrying that the planet's going to heat up to the point where we can't live here?
Well, we should always worry about everything, shouldn't we? So, having more impetus to make more better decisions sooner is very helpful for the long run. Now, there's a counter argument to the green decarbonization argument, and that counter argument is you've seen anywhere between 15% and maybe 30% of the world's billions of people over the last 150 years rise up from pretty awful, dismal living circumstances and enter the world that you and I know sitting here in our comfortable places with central heat and enough food to eat. And much of the rest of the world is actually still not there or maybe halfway on that journey. The burning of fossil fuels and contributing of carbon to the atmosphere has been an engine for our uplift. And if we now say, okay, gang, can't do it anymore, in some ways we are solidifying our privilege and locking out these others. Now, that's a theory. I think it is highly exaggerated. But what's important about that theory is to have the transition period ethics front of mind, right? So you don't want to say, ultimately, let's limit human potential for the sake of the planet. The planet will be fine. It will take care of itself. There's a wonderful evolutionary geologist named Lynn Margulies who used to teach at University of Massachusetts at Amherst. A character, a genius. She's one of the two people who created what's called the Gaia hypothesis, which was triggered in part by space travel. We look back at the Earth and we say, good Lord, it's a single gorgeous organic unit. If we start thinking about the Earth as one organism with trillions of interdependent parts, we'll make different and better decisions, right? So she's had huge impact on how people think about these things. And when I asked her that question, when I was a somewhat younger and more nervous person, she said, don't worry about the Earth. The Earth is so resilient. The Earth will be fine. Worry about the people. And because we're the fragile ingredient.
Right. We're the fragile part of the
ego. She wasn't saying, don't be really concerned about the environment and decarbonization. She wasn't connecting to that
right.
You know, more kind of right than left argument. But she was saying something fundamental about, you know, geological era time, which is that humans have been a fairly miserable species. And, you know, on the evolutionary scale for the last couple of minutes, we've had this elevation. That's much more fragile than whether we're really going to blow up the Earth or destroy the Earth's ecosystem. And you can see this, you know, you look at the various measurable predictions on this issue going back 50, 60 years. We're not good at predicting a quantified impact. And we are not, if you become very scientific, you know, the whole Dunning-Kruger effect thing, the less you know about something, the more you think you know more, right? I'm not expert enough to know how ignorant I really am until I get that undergraduate degree in a subject. Then you're like, oh, man, we know nothing. What's next? It'll be more exciting. What we know about the Earth's resilience and fragility is very important, and there's plenty of risk. But there are probably some major surprises, most of which I believe will be leaning toward less gloom and doom, and more ways we can harness and support and accelerate the resilience of these natural systems.
Well, let's talk a little bit. Yeah, so I'd like to hear a little bit about this, because you have a bird's eye seat in the CEO's office to talk to some of these folks about some of the research and development they're doing, some of the planning they're doing around decarbonization. And you, as a social scientist, I mean, you see the net effect. You can say, okay, this company and this guy that I just talked to will be responsible for lowering carbon into the atmosphere by X percent. You can see that in these conversations as you lead them and generate them. It was obvious in the last session that you had here in Detroit. All these people had very specific ideas about what they were going to do to reduce that carbon footprint. So what are the most promising technologies or practices that companies are undertaking that give you optimism about the state of our future?
Yeah, so two or three different things. And to start, in a gray area, you mentioned the whole carbon offsets idea. I was just on the phone with a senior person at Shell. Yeah, they've got a $1.4 billion venture fund, and that's going almost entirely into clean energy, lower carbon solution development. They also spend an enormous amount of money doing things like buying or supporting planting of new massive forests, taking credit for the new trees that will pull out and hold on to lots of carbon, right? Which will allow them to stay largely in the natural gas business, which we used to think was clean and now we know is not, right? And natural gas, by the way, scope one is when you do the thing you do, or you burn the thing or use the thing you make, how dirty is it? Natural gas is really clean when you burn it. Number two, what's the whole life cycle of this thing? How did you make this thing and get it to market where it's going to be used? About 7% of natural gas escapes from the time we uncork it out of the earth to the time we burn it in our furnace. And it turns out it is a blanket. It is an insulator for all the radiation that comes back up off the earth that causes global warming or climate change.
So it's having the same impact as fossil fuel.
Because it's an insulator times 50 or 100 compared to CO2, right?
Whoa.
So you have a terrible impact, and that's scope two. Now scope three is not just everything you do. I mean, you can make the cleanest fuel, but if you're making it housed in dirty buildings with people who commute great lengths, and then you put it on a ship that's dirty that goes from here to there, your scope three number will be bad because you're buying not only your emissions numbers, but all of your major supply chain partners' numbers.
Right.
So that's a really interesting example of a shift.
Right.
Natural gas was expensive, then it got super cheap. It goes up and down. Fracking often is a source in the U.S. of, you know, quote unquote, energy dependence. I can tell you that what's hopeful about that is how seriously people are taking these things. And they're taking them seriously in the boardroom with very few exceptions. Across industries, and again, electric utilities, some manufacturing, it's not an early leader.
But you're saying that even in the Shells and in the Chevron's offices, they're taking this seriously.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And by the way, there was a time when we had both Shell over here out of Amsterdam and ExxonMobil in Texas as active members of our institute. Exxon was a laggard, no question. Even though they were spending, you know, a billion or so in clean energy research, Their $300 billion a year was oil and gas, not energy. Shell fought that battle earlier with the EU and lost. And they are very much a creature of the EU, doing more earnestly to make energy transition the core business. A year and a half ago, there was a board revolt at Exxon, and they're still digesting it, but they have high-level commitment and intent to really get the energy transition agenda front and center. And right now, their fastest-growing business unit is Clean Energy Solutions. So that change is afoot, and it will only accelerate. Michelle might backstep a little bit, but it's inevitable. It's profitable. The profit motive is what makes this real, at least in our country. And what we've seen in Europe is far ahead on the conversation about decarbonization. They're far ahead on creating committees and steps and associations. And the actual steps that they're taking are good, but really slow. American businesses have had, honestly, until 4 or 5 years ago, relatively little progress on this front. Because the bigger companies that are the leaders naturally, because they control so much cash flow, have either been resistant or very cynical and checking the box, but not being completely honest about it. This transition is happening right now. And what we're already seeing is as the American firms jump on, they're starting from behind, but they're moving so much faster than the European firms. And I could give you some funny examples of, you know, the committee to create the standards to start doing the project scoping out of Europe. That has great articulated values, but less happening versus, you know, the cigar chomper who says, you know, I'm still not going to vote for Hillary, but let's go make this money, get it done. And that's obviously a caricature, but there's some real truth to it.
To that.
And interesting. That's the most hopeful thing. The scientific advances are incredible. One of the things that pulled us into this whole sector is we were advising a $5 billion a year, $4 billion a year, employee-owned construction company, a really, really well-run, very ethical company called Black & Veatch out of Kansas City on a new venture accelerator, right? They have a clean energy venture accelerator that they do a great job with. And, you know, we have expertise, but more than that, we have a lot of connections to people in that space. And then when I went to, I think it was their fourth kind of graduating class ceremony out there in Kansas City, and I heard new venture after new venture present that they had helped to incubate. Every one of them, you know, having lived through the rise of the commercial internet, spending enough time in Silicon Valley to have some sense of the rhythm, every one of them was shaped like the perfect startup. It's like, here's our CTO, recent PhD with DOD funding, with NEH funding, recent DOD leader in this new or maturing technology, just got, you know, her second PhD at Carnegie Mellon. She's our CTO. Here's our CEO, two successful venture-backed exits already. And here are our list of initial investors. And it's five global giant right. companies who are investing because as this thing matures, they want to be huge customers. Because they want to deploy it at scale. And I saw venture after venture that had that shape. And I said, man, this is what you saw 1999, 2000, after that famous dot-com bubble around the internet. There was a first wave that people made a lot of money from that accelerated things, poured too much capital in, and got things in motion. And then the real smarter, lasting, world-changing
venture. Very coming in and slowly building. Right.
Not AOL, not Netscape, okay. Where, you know, I would have been very happy to take the money from AOL and Netscape in those early days. But really, Microsoft, which we talked about as grandpa that doesn't get the internet, being in that space. You look at Google coming out early 2000s. I mean, the technology right. earlier, but not being a market leader until the 2000s. They were 10 years late to the party in some ways, but that's where you had, I mean, and if you know, right. you know the story, the story of the rise of Google, you have two of the most brilliant graduate students at Stanford who figure out math and, you know, they're the tip of the iceberg. They represent civilizational genius that they were able to understand and coordinate and start really working on. And they go to a professor who goes to his pal, you know, world's greatest VC, who writes them a check on the spot. It looks like startup in the garage time. And there was a little bit of that. But no, it was Stanford. It was the history of computational mathematics and 10 years of the internet and the whole VC community being there and ready to go. This is kind of the moment we're at now, I think, around decarbonization.
Which is why I had to have you and your individual, as opposed to collective genius, your individual genius here on the show today. So, Peter, I can't thank you enough. To our listening and viewing audience, this has been Disrupt Ed, the show where we talk to you about the impact that this 5G wired, workforce augmented, technology enabled, and globally interconnected world is doing to the world of work and learning. And Peter, if nothing else, you have excited me for your upcoming event here in Detroit. We're going to be hosting it here, so stay tuned. We're going to have Peter along with some of these executives to tell more about the business of decarbonization and the reassurance that new technology is on its way to solving one of the biggest climactic problems we have here on planet Earth. So, Peter, I can't thank you enough. It is always a treat. I could listen to you for hours. We will have you back with some of your colleagues at the event on May 31st here in Detroit. But in the meantime, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ron. I appreciate it enormously. As always, I hope to see you again soon.
Well, I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thank you.
Cheers. All right.